Hey, everybody, I'm Dick Tucson. I'm an alcoholic. It says Dick T from Las Vegas, Nevada. That's me. I was sitting in the back of the room and I wrote down some notes because I don't want to make the wrong pitch. Being a member of Oversexed Anonymous and AA, I don't want to give you the pitch about the other group. You're going to have to hear the standard, I puked, I got sober, and I laughed. That's it. Bob Darrell called me up a week or so ago and said the guy that was scheduled for this evening might not be able to come, and if so, would I fill in? And I says, yeah, whatever you want, I'll fill in. And as soon as I said that, he promptly left town. And I had a feeling as though he didn't want to listen to me. He's been listening to me for 25 years. I found Bob in a hospital in North Las Vegas. It was several of us AA members were taking meetings into this hospital in their rec room or whatever, small room. And we make little pitches trying to get these people that were residents there to maybe get a hold of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he picked me out and asked me to be a sponsor. I said, oh, shit. He had long red hair, red beard, never had a razor on his face. It's just natural beard growth and sandals. And I thought, this dumb son of a bitch is trying to be Jesus Christ. But I took him on as a sponsor. No big deal. No big deal. I know he's a member of this group, isn't he? Is he still a member? My sponsor is Ted Davis. He's older than I am. And you heard tonight how old I am. And Ted said, he said, when he was 80 years old, he was real proud that he could get an erection. And I'm really looking forward to that. And my lady Valerie's looking forward to it. I guess I better get down to the puking. My last drunk, everybody has a last drunk. Mine was 100 days in the summer of 63. It's a little over 3 months in case you're trying to figure out. I bummed around the country. I did a lot of weird stuff. I burgled as much as I could. I stole from anybody I could steal from. I stole a car, you know, and I drove it until it quit, and then I'd take another one. And I'd take the license plates off, and I'd trade them in for other license plates. You could always find license plates in the back row of a used car lot. Because those are cars they just pulled in there, and they don't want them. Nobody wants them. But sometimes they'll have license plates on them, and I'd use those so I wouldn't get in trouble. I did that quite a bit. I'm not a silk sheet drunk. I don't know much about it. I own some silk sheets. But what I am, I'm really a puker. And silk sheet drunks don't puke. They gag once in a while, but they don't let it go. I was a bartender around town for about 20 years, and I drank on shift. Naturally, why else would you go to work? I That's why I was a bartender, because I can get free drinks. I never missed a shift for being sick. I always got to work because that's where the free booze was. Why wouldn't I go to work? I went to work not on time all the time because sometimes I couldn't get up. You know, it's tough. I worked graveyard shift, 1 o'clock in the morning till 9. And it's tough to go to bed at 9 or 10 o'clock at night and get up at midnight. Especially if you went to bed drunk. It's tough. So there was times when I couldn't get to work on time. And the bartender that I was relieving, he got tired of me, really tired of me. And I'd apologize and I'd promise him, you know, I'll come in to work early. I'll come in early tomorrow and I'll cover for you. You can go home early. He says, don't be early, don't be late. Just be on time. Be here. And he was hot. I don't blame him. I don't blame him. I wasn't a very good guy to follow through on him. My last drunk started as a result of me not being able to get to work on time. I had to stop at the El Cortez on my way into work and have a couple drinks in order to get to work, to have free drinks. I just had to. I just couldn't get any further down Fremont. So I was able to park in front of the El Cortez at that time. And didn't seem to be a problem. I'm going back quite a few years. And I went in and there was a 21 dealer working there that I knew pretty well. And I said, well, I'll go over and make a little bet and maybe I'll make him some money. And I made some money. And I went over to the bar and I bought the bar a drink. And he made some money and tips. And I sat there until I was late. So I called up and told him I'd be a little bit late. And I ran out of money there, about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And I went to a guy who's a friend of mine who owned a casino in North Las Vegas. I said, I need some money, and I want a check. And so he gave me a counter check, and I filled it out. And he said, is this any good? I said, hell no, just keep it till you see me. And I took off down the road. And that was the start of my 100-day drunk. I didn't have a lot of those 100-day drunks, but I had enough of them that really impressed me. On that drunk, I woke up in a motel in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. I didn't know that there was a place called Jacksonville Beach. I thought I was in Jacksonville, but I was over on the beach, whatever that is. And I'm in this motel room, and I got some guy. I picked him up. He was hitchhiking, and I was in a stolen car. And so he didn't drink like I did, but he wanted to eat. And eating wasn't important to me. Drinking was. And I'd send him to the store, and he'd get me some vodka and get himself something to eat. They had a vodka in Florida at the time. I doubt if any of you have ever heard of this. They had a vodka made out of trash oranges, orange pulp, just whatever, you know, whatever they had left after they took everything out of oranges that they could possibly get. They'd cook it and get alcohol off of it, and that was the vodka. And it was $2.99 a fifth. A long time ago, and bad vodka. But I drank it. And the main problem with it was when I would wake up perspiring, I smelled like rotten oranges. At least I thought I did. And I'd go in and shower, and I'd drink some more of that orange vodka, and I'd smell like rotten oranges. Couldn't get rid of it. A gal come and knocked on the door after quite a few days in there. And she told me I had to get out, and that if I didn't get out by 1 o'clock, it was on a Sunday, she was going to call the police. I didn't want that. So I got out, and I was sick, sick. You people know how sick I was. And the liquor stores are closed on Sunday in Florida. They were at that time. I couldn't get a drink. I drove halfway through Florida, south. And I went into this one gas station to buy a little gas. And I asked the guy where I could get a drink, and he looks at me like I'm a cop. I don't look like a cop. I look like a sick drunk. But I says, I really need something. He told me where I could get a six-pack of 3-2 beer. Well, it's pretty hard to get well on 3-2 beer. But I tried. And I couldn't hold it down, and I couldn't get well. I got over to Tampa, which was open. And I got me some vodka. And I went in a park, a little park alongside a waterway, and sat there and drank that vodka. And I came to life. I was able to live. I'm an alcoholic. There might be quite a few other things wrong with me, but I'm an alcoholic. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I headed north. I did a lot of things wrong with that car. I stole a lot of stuff. At one time, I remember I had the back seat full of musical instruments. Full. I probably had 10 pieces. Does anybody hear a noise? Because if you don't, I'm in trouble. I had all these musical instruments, and I knew I couldn't sell them too close to where I got them, and I wasn't sure where I got them, but I thought it was Massachusetts. So I drove south and west, and I got past Pennsylvania, and I sold some of them in Ohio. I didn't go to a pawn shop because they're too hot to sell in a pawn shop. I wound up going to musical stores, and those guys are just as crooked as the guys in the pawn shop. You know, same kind of people, as far as I was concerned. I'd take an $80 horn, get in there, and they'd give me $8 for it. I'd piss and moan and try to get 10. Sometimes I'd get it and sometimes I wouldn't. But that was all right. Give me a tank of gas and a bottle of vodka. I eventually changed from vodka. I didn't want to get drunk and get put in jail because I knew I was wanted in several places. I didn't want to go to jail. So I switched to wine. And then I switched to 20% wine, the cheap wine that they fortify with sugar. I knew quite a bit about this because I had been in the liquor business for 20 years and I tended bar for 20 years. So I knew quite a bit about what I was doing. That's not right. I tended bar for 20 years, but I hadn't been in the whiskey business at that time. And I mixed that wine, and all it did was make me sleepy, and I couldn't drive if I was sleepy. So I got a bottle of vodka, and I'd mix half wine and half vodka. And I got some pills. I stopped at a doctor's office and told him that I was trying to get to Florida. My son had broken his back in four places, and I couldn't sleep. I was going to have to stay awake, and I needed some pills to stay awake. I got some. And I wrote him a phony check. And I got to the drugstore and I got the pills with another phony check. And between taking these uppers to keep me awake and drinking the white port and vodka, I didn't know who I was talking to in that car, but I kept the conversation going. Conversation never dried up. I just kept talking. And every once in a while, I'd look over to the side, and nobody would be there. And then I'd look over later on, and somebody would be there. I don't know if you people understand that or not. Anyway, I went across country to Seattle. And I was going to commit suicide in Seattle. And I bought a pistol in Seattle. You can buy a pistol there without any identification. Nice town. So I bought a pistol, and I had to have some shells. So I had to buy a box of shells. I was going to commit suicide. I wasn't going to shoot anybody else. I was going to shoot me. And had this box of shells. I had 50 shells and I only needed one. What was I going to do with the other 49? I'd like to trade it in for a bottle of vodka. You know, you don't need these shells near as much as you need a bottle of vodka. I couldn't figure out any way to get rid of those 49 shells. Only needed one. I wasn't going to make any mistakes. I never got rid of that box of shells. I wound up getting sober with that box of shells here in Las Vegas. As you know, I didn't commit suicide. But I decided I didn't want to do it in Seattle. I wanted to do it in San Francisco because I had really had a lot of fun in San Francisco. It was a drinking town, really a drinking town, back in the 50s. And I wanted to decide I wanted to die there. So I got down there and I'll tell you the kind of room I got. I paid $9 a week for the room. Well, you know what kind of a room it was. That would be equal to about a $25 room now. And I went to a bookstore. Now, I have no reason to go to a bookstore. I hadn't read a book since I was in high school, and I had never completed reading a book in high school. I just wasn't a reader. So I have no idea why I'm in this bookstore. And in the back of the room, towards the back, is the section on psychology, suicide, all these subjects are tied in together. And there's quite a section. There might have been 300 or 400 books in that section on sick thinking, what it basically was. And I stole one of those books, one that made sense to me. You know, why would a guy who never reads a book steal a book? I have no idea. But I bought a bottle of vodka and a bottle of white port, and I went to my hotel room, if you can call it that, to read this book. The book was Man Against Himself, written by Dr. Menninger. And it seemed to sort of make sense to me, you know, the title. And I glanced through the book, you know, and it sort of made sense to me. And I stole that book. And after I read it, read that book, I decided I want to go to Topeka, Kansas, where Dr. Menninger had a clinic. And I got out on the road and I started walking because I didn't want to get caught for hitchhiking in California with my little rap sheet. It wouldn't have been good. So I walked. I walked quite a ways. And I finally had the courage up to hitchhike and I got a ride, naturally. And I got to Oklahoma and knew that I had to go north from Oklahoma City. Made the turn on the highway going north, and I got picked up by the Fuzz, and they booked me for hitchhiking. And I got 15 days for hitchhiking from this judge. I didn't have no place to go, really, so it didn't make no difference. So I got out in about 12 days, something like that, and I went back up on that same road. I'm going to hitchhike up to Kansas. I get nailed again. Go back, and the judge says, "Weren't you just in here a couple weeks ago?" And I said, "Yes, Your Honor." He said, "Well, maybe I'll teach you a lesson this time. I'll give you 30 days. I said, "Okay, you know, all right, whatever." So now I'm doing 30 days, which I did 24, 25, don't matter. You don't get out till they say you're out anyway. I go back up on that road again because I want to go to Kansas. I ain't trying to stay in Oklahoma City. I get busted again. This third time, this judge says, "Young man, do you know what you're doing?" I says, "Yes, evidently life on the installment plan." I said, "I hitchhiked into your town. I'm going to hitchhike out." And he says, "No, you're not." And he told these two cops that were there, "Take me out, way out on this road." way out, till they couldn't see anything of Oklahoma City behind them, and turn me loose and sit there and watch me walk over the farthest hill. And I did. And I hitchhiked, and I got a ride, and I got out of that goddamn Oklahoma. And I got to Kansas. And I got to Menninger Clinic. And I tried to get in, and she said, "I'm sorry, we can't take you here." She said, "This is a very expensive place. And you know what I look like. I've been drinking for 100 days. You know what I look like." I wasn't going to tell all this stuff, but I'm into it now. You're going to have to listen. I've heard it before, so it really is no big deal. If you decide not to listen, it's all right. She said, "Wait, we've got a state hospital here in Topeka. Would you go there?" I said, yeah, I'll go there. So she called him up and said, "Yeah, send him over." So I had to walk clear across Topeka to get to this second hospital. And my shoes got holes in about the size of this thing, you know. About, I don't have any bottoms. I got tops, but I don't have any bottoms. Which reminds me, I used to drink a drink when I was working on Fremont Street. I drank a drink of half kosher wine and half brandy. And I called it tops and bottoms. I just thought of that because I mentioned my shoes. It was a hell of a drink. If you remember what it was now, you can't have any until you get to heaven. But when you get there, be sure you ask for it. Tops and bottoms. Good drink. Anyway, I walked over to that state hospital, and she says, "Come on in. Can we help you?" And I said, "I hope so. I need something. I'm a very sick man." And by this time, I'm out of money. I don't have any Trump. And she says, "What's your address?" And the last one I had was Las Vegas. And she says, "Oh, you're not from Kansas?" And I says, "No. I just came here to see Dr. Menninger and the whole story." She says, "Well, we can't take you in here unless you're a resident of Kansas." "Okay." She says, "Wait a minute. Are you a veteran?" And I said, "Yes." She says, "Well, there's a veterans hospital here. Would you go there?" And I said, "Yeah." So she called over there. And he says, "Yeah, send him over." Now, I had to walk clear back across Topeka in my basically bare feet. This hospital is right beside the Menninger Clinic. You could throw a rock from one to the other. And I go in there, and this guy behind the desk, I told him what I was there for, and he says, "Let me see your discharge." I said, "Discharge? I don't even have a driver's license. You're asking me for a discharge?" And I proceeded to really, really tell him off. And I thought I ought to really teach him some fisticuffs. And he uncoiled from under that desk, and he's about 6'6". Reality set in. And I knew I had no business saying another word to this giant. So I walked out, and I went to a mission. Spent the night in a mission. I made a little money in the next week doing odd jobs. And I thought, when Monday comes, I was out of the mission. I was in the flop house there. When Monday comes, I'm going to go to work. No more of this goddamn messing up. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to change. And it was a Saturday afternoon, and I thought, I'll go sit in the movie theater. I can sit in there all day, maybe sleep, but I won't be disturbed. Nobody will bug me in there. So I sat there all day, and I came out, and there was a tavern, and I was thirsty. And it was just a beer bar. And I had a beer. And I had two beers. And I had three beers. And I wasn't drunk. And the guy beside me, he had a bottle under the bar. that the bartender controlled. And so he'd pour himself a drink, and I'm talking to him, and he said, would you care for a drink? I said, no, I better not. He said, come on, have one. It's all right. All right, I'll have one. I didn't have one. I had several of them. And I wound up leaving that place and going to a liquor store and getting white port and vodka and going to my room. When Monday came, I didn't have any money. And the fuzz came. And they wanted to know what I was doing. I said, well, not much of anything right now. And they says, I had a pistol on the dresser because I was going to commit suicide, of which you can tell I didn't do. And they says, what's that on the dresser for? I says, that's to kill myself with when I get enough courage. He says, you sure you haven't been doing something else with it? I said, would I be in a $9 a week flop house if I was doing something else with it? He said, we want you to come downtown, talk to Father so-and-so. Your wife got a hold of him. He's been shaking the town down looking for you. I said, is there any charge against me? He says, no. I said, okay, under those conditions, I'll come. Like if there was a charge, I wouldn't come. You know. But anyway, I went down there, and the police chief, I presume he was the chief, he was behind the big desk, and this priest were there, and they were asking me a bunch of questions, which I couldn't answer, didn't know how to answer, didn't want to answer. And I started crying, and I just sobbed, just like the dam opened up, and just sobbed. But that was the start of my sobriety. I didn't know that. And it wasn't the last drink I had. I didn't know that. Well, I called my wife, which they had strongly suggested, in Las Vegas, and told her that I'd meet her in Denver at the Greyhound Bus Depot. I was in Kansas, as you know, and I hitchhiked to Denver, and she flew to Denver, and we met and had a couple drinks and talked to whether I should be allowed to come home or not. So she said if I went to AA, it'd be okay to come home. So we got on that plane, and at that time they had free drinks. They had miniatures, and I had two. Miniatures are allowed two drinks. And I had two miniatures of Cutty Sark, and she says, I don't want anything, and I kicked her. She said, oh, give me the same as him. So I had four miniatures on that flight back, and that was the end of my drinking. The next day, I went to that A&A thing. Didn't want to. Didn't think I needed it. But I went because I'd just gotten in the house. You know, I wasn't in the bedroom, but I was in the house. That's an improvement. I was on the couch, which was all right. I went to AA because I had no place else to go. And I didn't know whether they were going to accept me or not. And the guy that I called the TIE Club, it was on North 9th at the time, and the guy on the phone got out of line with me. And I thought, I'm going down there and teach him a lesson in fisticuffs. I was always going to teach somebody a lesson. I wasn't very big. You can see how big I am now. I wasn't very tough. I ain't very tough now. In case you want to challenge me, I'm easy. But I'm going to whip this guy down at the TIE Club. I don't know who he is. Don't know what he looks like. And I started walking up the stairs. The club was upstairs. And I started walking up those stairs. Each step I took, I got weaker and weaker and weaker. And by the time I got up to the top, man, I'm not going to fight anybody. I'm scared to death. So I went in and the guy come over. I guess I looked scared to death. He come over and shook my hand. I think he said, I'm Joe. And I'm an alcoholic. I said, well, my name's Dick Toussaint, and I don't know if I'm an alcoholic or not. He said, well, nobody here will call you an alcoholic. You'll either decide that for yourself, or you'll go out and do some more drinking. And I was impressed that he didn't jam anything down my throat, didn't insist that I do anything. he just said, if, you know, if it don't work for you, you'll probably go out and do some more drinking. Sit down and have a cup of coffee. And I wasn't in too good a shape, you know, a little rattly. Not so much that you could see it, but I felt it, that I was rattly on the inside. And I went to a meeting that night. I didn't want to. I didn't want to listen. I didn't think these people knew anything. It was in North Las Vegas behind Jerry's Nugget in a church that's back there. And there was about 30 people in that meeting. That's more drunks than I've seen in a meeting in a room in a long time. I got out of there, and the guy said, what do you think of that? And I said, well, not too much. He said, what do you do for a living? I said, well, I'm a bartender by trade. He said, we got a bartender in the program. You want to go talk to him? I said, sure, I'm out for the evening. And we went down to Bunny's Bar in North Las Vegas. Rusty was behind the bar. And he called him out from behind the bar, and he starts talking religion to me, strong religion, and I can't stand it. I cannot stand it. And I'm backing up, and I know where the door is, and I'm heading for that door. I'm backing up, you know, I'm walking around the pool table getting towards the door, and he's talking Jesus Christ to me, and I can't stand it. I just can't stand it. I finally get out there, and I said, I thought you told me this was no religion. He said, well, I don't. He said, it's not. It's not a religion. He said, I don't know why Rusty came on so strong about that, but he said, it's not a religion. Did I hear a bell? Somebody's going to have to help me out here. Come on, Alan. I didn't do anything.
Let me try moving you back about 2 feet.
Thank you. Want me to start over? I'll start over. I was born at a very early age. I was a kind of a drunk that had no God in his life. I was raised Catholic. I was raised with Jesus Christ. I knew all about it. I could discuss it in detail. I didn't approve of it. But you see, I was a kind of a drunk that didn't approve of any authority. And I had a tough time with that. I didn't approve when I was in the army. I didn't approve of anybody who had authority over me. No one. When I'd have a job, I didn't think the guy that hired me knew anything, not near as much as I did. And bar managers that I worked for, I would tell them, you're the dumbest son of a bitch I ever worked for. And I'd get another job a year later, and I'd have to tell him how dumb he was. But that was me. I just had no respect for any authority. And, of course, the epitome of authority is God, you know. I couldn't handle it. I was lucky enough to get into doing retreats here in Vegas. And I didn't plan this. The gal I was married to that died about 10 years ago, we had a lady up, Louise Robinson, for dinner one night. And Louise said she had moved to Vegas a year or so earlier. She said, you know what I don't like about Las Vegas, AA? I said, no, tell me. She said, they don't have any retreats. I said, what's a retreat? So she tried to tell me, but she didn't know. She just knew how to go to them, and she didn't know what they were about. So I said, let's put one together. We can do that. By this time, I was really into doing whatever it was for AA. You know, I was very service-oriented. To tell you to what extent I was service-oriented, I've had every job in the state of Nevada. Every job. And a lot of them, I never knew what I was supposed to do. By the time I was through serving, I knew what I was supposed to do. I always knew after the fact, never before the fact. Anyway, I couldn't take this God thing. For this retreat, Louise got a hold of Chuck Chamberlain, and at first he said he'd do it, and then Chuck called back to Louise and said, I better not do it. He said, I'm too sick. I'm really not a healthy man. And to put on a retreat, which is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, he said, it just takes too much out of me. I'm going to pass. But there's a Catholic priest in San Diego who will do a good job for you. He's in AA. So she got a hold of him. It was her job. My job to get the location and all the logistics and get the food and all that stuff. Her job was to get the speaker and take care of him. So she got a hold of this father, and he comes to town, and I thought, man, this son of a bitch is going to do something Catholic to these people. I know damn well he's going to try to convert every son of a bitch to Catholicism. And I'm going to have to stand up to him. And this was my attitude. Well, he never said a word about Catholicism. He talked all AA. He talked about the steps. He talked about love of one A for another. He talked about the love of God for his fellow man. He talked about the triangle of God, me, and my fellow man, the three people. And he talked about the love of these three entities being all-inclusive. And a little bit of it started making sense. He was so soft and so peaceful that I was able to become a little bit soft and a little bit peaceful. That wasn't so much against God. Not so much. The next year we had a retreat and we had a different Catholic priest. It seems to be there's no end to the supply of alcoholic Catholic priests. So we had another one, and he and I became friends. And we talked about my inability to get along with God, and he didn't seem to mind it. You know, he didn't preach to me like the priest that I was raised with in my hometown. You know, they come on strong to me. Because I didn't believe in God then, but I couldn't say too much. You know, when you're 12 years old, you got to sort of keep your mouth shut. Anyway, after that second time, the second retreat, I started believing that maybe there was a God. Maybe he would help me. My sponsor was talking to me about this time, about me saying, he wasn't my sponsor. He was the guy that wanted to be my sponsor, and I wouldn't let him. I thought anybody that wants to be my sponsor is too dumb for me to be my sponsor. So I wouldn't let him be my sponsor, but he said, I'd like to have you do something for me tonight. I said, what's that? He said, when you go to bed, I'd like to have you say thank you. I said, no. I know what you're aiming at, and I'm not going to do it. He says, try it. What do you got to lose? He said, when you turn the lights out, just say thank you. I told him I wasn't going to do it, but I did it. And after a couple of weeks, he says, how's that working for you, that saying thank you? I said, no difference, no changes, nothing. It don't work for me. He says, I want you to do one more thing for me. He said, in the morning when you wake up, I want you to say, help me. I said, no, that's just like the one you got me saying at night. I'm not going to do that. He said, well, try it. What do you got to lose? So I did. Didn't tell him. He wanted to be my sponsor. I didn't want that. So I get up in the morning and I'd say, thank you. Help me. Big steps. A couple weeks later, he's asking me about this, and I'm telling him, it ain't helping me, not a goddamn bit. He said, I want you to go one step further. He said, I want you to say, thank you, God, at night, and God help me in the morning. I want you to use God in both phrases. No, I'm not going to, you're not going to, no, I'm not going to. But I did. But I didn't tell him. I was getting help and I didn't want to admit it. Things were getting better. I found out that AA works in funny ways. You know, you can't nail it down and say, this happened and this happened. I know God did this for me. You know, that ain't the way it worked for me. But it was getting better, and I knew it. And I knew it wasn't coming from me. Surprise. I've learned to get along with God pretty good, really. I'm very satisfied to have God in my life. And if you think I'm preaching, I don't mean to be. I'm very lucky that I found God, and I'm lucky that my head changed enough for me to listen to what God has to say. Sometimes he talks to me. And you might think that's a little goofy, but sometimes I hear things that don't really come out of my head. I mean, they come out of my head, but I didn't put them in there. Does that make sense? My head. Anyway, about 2 or 3 months ago, I had someone tell me about when they get on their knees to pray. He gets all through and he puts out his arms and says, "Surprise me." I think that's neat, so I've been trying that. He hadn't surprised me very much, but I'm available to be surprised. I did get a phone call yesterday. Some guy who is in Las Vegas wanted to ride to a meeting, and I didn't take him. And I told him I was coming here tonight, but I said I'm going to be with a lot of friends, and I don't know how many of my friends you can stand. They're not very high-class friends. They're all drunks. Oh, I would like that. So I said, I'll call you Friday morning, because some people want to go out to dinner tonight, and this guy, I didn't know he wanted to go. I haven't met him yet. I just talked to him on the phone. But it was nice that I got that little surprise from God. So tomorrow, he and I will hook up, and sometime tomorrow, we will go to a meeting together. And if the creek don't rise, we'll go to a meeting at Samaritan House on Saturday morning. I got a question to ask you. I think I asked this of Bobby one time. How do you know when you're out of invisible ink? It's always bothered me. In fact, I'm afraid to buy invisible ink because I don't want to mess up and be out of it when I'm still writing. Why do they put expiration dates on sour cream? Just something that bothers me. The other week, I was here for a little 10-minute pitch like Stan. By the way, Stan did a hell of a job. Where is he? Good job. There's three words in the back of the big book: honesty, open-minded, and willingness. But these are the essentials of recovery. And when I was growing up in AA, they took the first letters of those three words, and it was the HOW of the program, H-O-W. And I was able to understand, I was able to buy that and keep that for myself, H-O-W. I wasn't honest. I had learned to be a little bit open-minded as I went along. And I was willing once in a while, not too much. I have come to rely on those three words. And of the three, the most important word in recovery to me is willingness. Willing to be open-minded, willing to try to be honest, willing to listen, willing to change, willing to help out, willing to take a job in AA, willing to help another drunk. Willing. Got to be the most important word in AA. I don't know of another one that could surpass willingness. very important to me. I work on my 10th step usually every day, not very long and not well enough, but I try to work on it. And in the process of working on my 10th step, which is to see, you know, what I've done wrong during the day, try to change it and try to be a better person. I was told about the three C's, which most of you have probably heard about, but they became important to me. The three C's are criticize, condemn, and complain. And if I wouldn't do those, I'd be just about perfect. But I do criticize, condemn, and complain. I did stop after I started using them for myself. I did stop criticizing, condemning, and complaining out loud. But I didn't quit doing them. You know, I'd criticize about my eggs in the morning, even if I cooked them. I criticize, condemn, you know, if I did that kind of stuff, I'd get drunk. I don't know why that son of a bitch ain't drunk. And complain about what's going on in the world, in the neighborhood, in my family. Just complain, complain, complain. Not find good in it, complain. So I try to control this under my breath, where I live, inside where I live, and that's tough. I'm not able to do it. But I'm aware that I'm not able to do it, and I'm aware that I need to work on it to try to not criticize, condemn, and complain other people, other situations, things that really are not that important to me. I'm going to draw this to a close. I think I'm supposed to talk till 8:30. I'm not a believer in what a lot of people do in AA now. Most people do in AA. I've been sober 42 years, so when I talk, sometimes I'm going back in history. You know, I don't believe you have to take the steps in rotation. I know they're numbered 1 through 12. But if you can't take one step, does that mean you have to get drunk? If you can't take two steps, does that mean you have to stop and go out and play saloon for another 2 years and come back? I couldn't take the steps in rotation. My sponsor was the kind of a guy that allowed me not to have to take them. He says, well, I told him I couldn't take step one. I didn't think I was powerless over booze. And that was a thorn in my side for a long time. I could take step two because I thought I was crazy, and I thought that maybe these people in AA could help me with my insanity. And I didn't want to take step three because God was in there. And I didn't want to take step four because I didn't want to go to prison. And if you don't take step four, you don't have to take step five. And if you don't take four and five, there's no need to take six and seven because it says after taking these, then you go to six and seven. I didn't have to take them. He says, what about eight? He says, can you take eight? I says, yeah, I can make out a list of people that I owe. He says, that's more than just money. He says, a lot of people you might owe apologies to. And I didn't know how much he knew about me. And he says, then after you take step eight, you have to take step nine. Can you do that? And I said, yeah, yeah, I can start paying them. I can make some amends financially if I had a job. And he says, well, don't worry about step 10, 11, and 12. He says, they'll come later. He says, just work on 2, 8, and 9. See what happens. Well, he seemed to understand me more than most people because I was willing to do that. That's big. Me willing to do that kind of stuff. Naturally, I took all the steps. Naturally, I realized that I was powerless over booze, all kinds of booze. I'm powerless over pot. I'm powerless over pills. I never took any coke, but I'm sure I'm powerless over coke. Well, maybe not as much as some of you. I'm very lucky to be a recovered alcoholic. I'll be an alcoholic all my life. Whatever I got, as you heard earlier, Stanley the stool pigeon, that I'm 80 years old today. I got sober when I was 37. You know, that's almost impossible. Just about impossible. And if you say, well, miracles really don't happen. Yes, they do. Yeah, they really happen. Thank you very much.